Hello, welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is USU's extension entomologist, Diane Alston. And we would love to have you join our conversation. It's a live program, and the toll-free number to call is 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you could be the first person to tweet us your question at #ZestyGarden. Diane, thanks for coming in.
That's always fun, Brian. Thanks for having me. And so call in with your questions, but also call in and support your local public radio station.
And you're a public radio contributor to UPR, thank you very much.
I am a sustaining member, yes.
So we've got a lot of things to talk about today, and with the blue sky that was outside, it was actually pleasant to walk without a coat on, at least in Cache County. One of the things that I wanted to quickly talk about, because there might still be some areas where this can be done, is the dormant oil spray. And then we've brought this up the last couple of weeks in the program, but it doesn't hurt hitting it again because it's a very easy preventative to apply to your trees and take care of some nasty insects later in the year.
Right. So for fruit trees in particular, and also shade trees where you had problems with aphids or scale last year, scale insects, those are some of the trees and shrubs that you want to target with these dormant oil sprays. As you mentioned, the neat thing about a dormant oil spray is that it's a pretty benign application in terms of negative impacts on the environment. It's very safe for people, and use a dormant oil material, which you can buy at your local garden store. It's a highly refined petroleum oil. It's safe to use on trees that aren't woody plants that aren't yet leafed or flowered out yet. And so you want to time this right when the buds are swelling and showing a little bit of either flower or leaf color at the tips, but before that actual tissue emerges from the bud. And you use the dormant oil at around a 2% concentration. That's the typical middle of the label rate.
And it's fairly inexpensive,
too. It's pretty inexpensive. It's easy to apply. What you're trying to do is suffocate the overwintering insects on the tree. And so you want to coat the limbs, the twigs, the branches of the tree. You want to only do the limbs and not the lower trunk. The reason for that is we do have predatory mites that overwinter down at the base of the trees, and we don't want to kill those. So we want to target our sprays for what we call where the scaffold limbs attach to the trunk, so where you see those crotches in the limbs that come down to the main trunk and up above. And for smaller trees that are typically like some kind of a semi-dwarfing or dwarfing fruit tree, it's pretty easy to get good coverage because you can stand there on the ground and do it. If you're talking about a large shade tree that you had, say a linden tree that you had aphids on last year, for example, that can be more difficult because then you're talking about a lot of height to access. And so the dormant spray may not be as conducive for large scale trees like that. But certainly ones where you can reach with your spray material, the dormant oil is a really nice way to get the season off to a good start and suffocate those overwintering aphid eggs and scale. It's also good on peaches for the peach twig borer, which overwinters as a larva on the limbs of the tree, and also some of our leaf rollers that do the same thing.
Is it easy to find someone commercially who would be willing to come to your home and do that?
There are commercial applicators that will spray fruit and shade trees, yes.
Because I'm thinking we just don't play in the sandbox, which is underneath the maple tree at certain times of the year because it just drips so bad with aphids. Mm-hmm. But someone who might be willing to pay to have someone come in, that might be worth having, especially if
right.
It's, I don't know, over your car or something.
Right, where it's over a sidewalk, porch, parking area where you get a lot of that honeydew dripping down. It's not very pleasant. For those larger shade trees, what often has become the more popular way to manage aphids is to use a systemic insecticide, where it's applied to the soil around the drip line of the tree or applied as an injection, for example. And those materials then move up into the upper limbs of the tree and are good for sucking insects like aphids. And so because of the challenge of getting sprays on large trees, sometimes that's the better option for those.
So the important part is I'm assuming, is that the dormant oil spray is pretty much passed for the Davis and Salt Lake and Utah counties.
Maybe apples are still okay. If they're just starting to open buds, you can still do that. But certainly peaches, apricots are in bloom, and so it's too late for those.
I know I'm okay in my yard for peaches. They're not even looking close, but I know there's an apricot up here on campus that's just across the parking lot from us that's in full bloom.
Right, so too late for that.
And is that mostly because it would damage the flowers and right. The insects have already hatched and they're on their way?
More so the former. I mean, certainly some of the insects have hatched, but a lot of times the aphids are still pretty small and the oil might still be effective. But the problem is once you have those flowers open, you will damage the flower and you won't get pollination. Now, our cold weathers, the flowers may already be dead, but the flowers will turn brown and fall off.
So what should you look for? Just what, a little bit of color? So it hasn't opened, just
right.
A little bit of color
swollen
showing.
Swollen buds, a little bit of color or tissue, either leaf or flower color showing.
And is that the same for most?
For any kind of woody plant material, whether it's ornamental or a fruit tree, yes.
Okay. So what can you do other than the dormant oil spray to keep insects out of your trees? I'm thinking of, are there any kind of biological controls, something that's not so... chemical heavy that you could put on your trees. For instance, I've got a peach that I know I'm just going to have to pull out because it has the peach twig borer that's in it. And once they get in, short of finding a knife and doing more damage anyway, trying to get the borer out of there, it's just going to be in the tree and eventually it's going to take over the tree and kill it and I'll just have to replant.
So that's what's called the greater peach tree borer, and this is a clearwing moth that the caterpillar or larva tunnels into the lower trunk of the tree, so it's right around soil line. And they do feed in the cambial tissue and can girdle and kill the tree. And so unfortunately for the homeowner, the primary approach has been to use an insecticide spray applied to the trunk. And at the time when it's appropriate to do so, when the moths are out and laying eggs, so before that happens. Fortunately for the commercial growers, they've really been able to move to a new technology, which is using pheromones called mating disruption. But you need at least an acre or larger in size of peach or apricot susceptible, nectarine susceptible trees to be able to use that mating disruption approach. It's not going to work on just a tree or two in the home yard.
So what's the difference? Is it just need to have enough mass?
Enough concentration of the pheromone in the area, enough trees that are spaced at a regular interval where you're hanging the devices that release the pheromone. And so you build up this concentration of pheromone in that area. And then what happens is the male moths are not able to find the female moths for mating, and so you don't get the egg laying and then the damage to the tree. So again, unfortunately for the homeowner, that's really not an option, and so it comes down to something like an insecticide for that particular insect. But there are other insects where we do have some good biological control. Most people are familiar with some of our common predators that feed on aphids. Lady beetles or lady bugs are the most well-known, but there's other insects too. There's surfeit flies, there's lacewings, there's a suite of small predatory bugs called big-eyed bug, nabis is I'm trying to remember the common name for nabis, damsel bug, and then also we have minute pirate bugs. So insects like that are common predators on small insects like aphids and mites. And those are here naturally in our environment. And so the best biocontrol that you can use are those that are already here and well adapted to our area. And so how do we encourage and conserve those? Well, the primary way is when you do use harsh insecticides that have wide activity, broad activity, you tend to eliminate these natural enemies. So that's one thing you can try to switch your garden program over to trying to use things like oils and soaps, targeted things like BT sprays for caterpillar pests that aren't toxic to these beneficials. The other main thing you can do is have diversity in your garden. So plant different kinds of flowering plants that provide a good nectar and pollen source. And the reason for that is that the adults of these natural enemies need a food source, so a sugar and a protein source, and that's where the flowers come in. And then they lay their eggs around where they find small insect prey for their larvae to eat. And so common flowers that are good for this are a lot of our wildflowers. Many of our perennial shrubby plants are very good. Basically, flowers that you see bees and insects coming to, those are the kinds of flowers that that will be attractive and provide these food sources.
I know one flower that I love growing, but back east it's not. I see it all over the place, and I think it's more of a weed, and that's goldenrod. And it's also, a lot of people can be allergic,
right?
Have allergic reaction to goldenrod. But I remember going to a garden center, Willard Bay Gardens, and they had this beautiful goldenrod that was in full bloom. It was about 4 feet tall, but it was just loaded with insects of all kinds.
So those are the kinds of plants,
thought,
you know.
I'm going to put one of those in.
Yep. So if you see bees and insects, you know, general types of insects coming to those flowers, they are a good, they produce a lot of nectar. And it doesn't always mean it's a big flower. It can be some of the small flowered shrubs and plants that actually have more nectar and pollen resources than some of the big flowers.
I'm just looking at a picture of a big-eyed bug. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what these were. I think I've been crushing them when I saw them, so I need to leave them alone.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to know for, you know, most people that aren't entomologists or haven't taken a class on entomology to know what's a good bug and what's a bad bug. And it is hard to know. And so,
does the Integrated Pest Management site from USU Extension have?
Yeah, we have
a repository
photos.
Of photos.
Yeah, we have a lot of good photos. We try in our advisories. We'll talk about those in just a minute. In our advisories, to show different kinds of beneficial insects and pictures of them, so people can get familiar with what they look like.
Well, I know you go to garden.usu.edu. That gets you, it's an entrance into all things garden through USU Extension. And I'm assuming that there's a link to the Integrated Pest Management.
There is there. So if you just pick on anything that has to do with insects, plant diseases, you'll get you to our website. Yep.
Well, we hope you'll join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You don't have to pledge to call in a question.
Nope.
You've probably pledged already, so you can do this guilt-free. 1-800-826-1495. Or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden. We're going to take just a quick moment here to give you the phone number and to talk about reasons to pledge, and we hope that you'll join us again here on The Zesty Garden. I'm joined by April Ashland. She is our guru for all things social media here on Utah Public Radio, and she's got her camera. She's been taking pictures all morning this morning, so you may see a few different faces that I gave this morning on our Facebook page. But April, what excites you about public radio? You're always excited about things about the station.
You know, I like public radio because I think, you know, at heart, I'm a journalist. I, you know, went through four and a half years of college to become a journalist. And I like that Utah Public Radio especially, you know, provides information, but also a greater look and more understanding for people who aren't necessarily as educated or who are educated. It's kind of a broad spectrum. Everyone can learn something from public radio.
Can you think of one thing that you learned from public radio? It's like, what's one of your favorite stories you've heard?
Oh, geez.
Sorry, I didn't give you a
okay,
heads
so,
up,
oh, you're fine. So on Access Utah one day, it was actually Science Questions, Sherry Quinn was talking about cheese. I love cheese. It's probably one of my favorite things in the world. And she talked about, you know, how it's made and why cheese is kind of addicting. It's because it has opiates in it. Who knew? So now I feel so much better about my love of cheese. So.
And do you have a favorite cheese?
I really like Munster, and I also like Havarti a lot. But pretty much if it's cheese, I'll eat it.
Havarti's really good. Yeah, we have a cheese fetish at our house. We go through a big block, those, what are they, 5-pound blocks of cheddar cheese within, you know, a couple of weeks, easily. Yeah. And it's a great snack to have. And public radio is like your block of cheese. You just keep going through it because you enjoy it so much. And you pay to get the block of cheese. And with public radio, we're asking for you to call after the fact. You've been listening and hope that you've enjoyed what you've heard. Call 1-800-826-1495 to make a pledge of support for Utah Public Radio and cheese. 800-826-1495 or also online at upr.org. And Diane, I'm going to ask you, how did you first start listening to public radio?
I started when I was a graduate student in North Carolina. I was a student at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, and they had a local public radio station. My parents were not public radio listeners, at least at the time when I was a child. I think they have been since. Maybe it just wasn't as popular in the 70s when I was growing up. But I started in grad school, and I think it was somebody just had it on in the lab where I was working. And so I said, wow, they have some interesting shows on there, you know, some of the NPR shows. They're probably different back then than what they are now. But certainly the news stories, All Things Considered, things like that were very real interest to me. And so I started becoming a regular listener. And I was very pleased when I moved here to find out that there was a local public radio station.
Well, I think All Things Considered and Morning Edition were just getting their start in the late 70s. So yeah.
So this, I was a grad student in the 80s. So by then, I think they were already on the air.
Well, I know for me, the first time that I listened to public radio, I was taking a journalism class, and the professor at the time said, you need to listen to this, and there's going to be a test. So I'm like, okay. I wasn't a big radio listener at that point, but I started listening so I could be ready for the weekly current events test. And I always aced the test because it seemed like every time I was listening, there's always some story that got brought up. And then I found out afterwards that listening to Utah Public Radio was this professor's way of giving the test. So, so it worked out pretty good.
A hidden agenda there.
Yeah. And I've been listening ever since.
Yeah. Because, and now you're on air.
Because once you get started listening,
it has become a habit.
It's a very addictive habit because you tune elsewhere and you go, I didn't get very much out of that. Or you don't get the background information. No. It's just headlines, quick little sound bites. That's not what happens on Utah Public Radio. And the Zesty Garden is a great example of the information that you get. There aren't that many hour-long gardening programs in commercial radio. And we're putting in the resources to make this happen. And our extension experts who come over every week, pretty much every week, I have an extension guest on. Diane's here every month. Dan's here every month. Call and pledge for either the Zesty Garden or your favorite public radio program. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Or you can go online to upr.org. We're going to have our mid program break and then be back with Diane Alston for the rest of the program, and we'll be talking insects, and we hope that you will also call with your questions or comment. 800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com.
Don't panic if your spring garden lacks the vim and vigor of the past. You can improve the health and beauty of your garden without starting over. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Remove any existing weeds and spread a 1 to 2 inch layer of compost over the soil surface in the garden. Earthworms, ground beetles, and other insects will move it through the soil and eventually down to where the bulbs and flowers are growing. Purchase one of the bulb planting auger bits. Drill holes into the soil between existing bulbs and perennials. This aerates the soil while moving the compost into the root zone of the existing plants. Then mulch the soil surface with shredded leaves, pine needles, or other organic matter. As these materials break down, they too will be moved into the soil to improve the growing conditions for your bulbs and other plants. Top dress every other year to keep your garden looking its best. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for UPR comes from Little Bloomsbury Foundation, promoting peace and hope in an uncertain world with their 7th annual Festival of Art, Music, and Storytelling, today through Saturday from 9 to 9 at 181 North 200 East in Logan. Information is at littlebloomsbury.org.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. In our gardening calendar, the first thing I need to mention is that the Tulip Festival at Thanksgiving Point is going on right now, and it goes through the first Saturday in April. So what is that? I don't have a calendar in here. Is that like the 3rd or something, or the 5th? Anyway, the peak of their color is this Saturday. So if you happen to be in the Provo area, go to Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh, and see their tulip festival, because they have thousands of tulips all over the place, and it would be a wonderful garden to see. There's a landscape design class that continues in Kaysville at USU's Botanical Center. Learn the basics of landscape design, such as how to draw, design, and choose the right plants. All materials needed for the class, including handbook, graph paper, and design tools, are included. Information is at utahbotanicalcenter.org. And Wasatch Community Gardens is having their annual plant sale. It's Saturday, May 11th from 8 to 1 p.m. in the Roland Hall School parking lot, 720 South Guardsman Way in Salt Lake City. The sale offers more than 30,000 plants, including heirloom tomatoes, vegetable starts, herbs, annual flowers, grasses, water-wise plants, Utah natives, and edible perennials. Information is at wasatchgardens.org. And then the Ogden Botanical Gardens is having a What's Bugging Your Fruit Trees and Turf Grass class. It is this Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon. Learn how to keep your fruit trees and grass healthy by controlling insects and diseases that can attack them. Then the Tahnaquint Nature Center in St. George, 1851 South Dixie Drive, has an All About Herbs workshop on Saturday, May 18th from 10 to 11. The workshop features everything you need to know about herbs and more, plus including selecting, growing, and culinary use and preserving. And then the Zion Canyon Farmers Market is April 27th, so it starts this Saturday through October 19th. It's 9 a.m. to noon every Saturday. And it's at the Bit and Spur Restaurant, located at 1212 Zion Park Boulevard in Springdale. And then the Cache Valley Gardeners Market is every Saturday from May 11th to October 19th. It will be this year at the Horseshoe Willow Park in Logan because of the construction going on where they've been the last couple of years. So remember to go out to Willow Park in Logan for this year's Cache Valley Gardeners Market. Do you have any items, anything coming up?
We do have an organic vegetable and fruit workshop that's going to be held down in Kaysville. It's not until June, so June 11th, so it's still a ways out there. But if you are interested in organic production techniques, learning about how to grow fruit and vegetables with organic methods, it will cover nutrition of the plants, irrigation, ground covers, building soil structure and soil health, as well as insect and disease pests. That's June 11th in Kaysville, and it is a workshop that you can sign up for online. We're advertising it through Eventbrite, and so if you just type in organic fruit and vegetable Utah in Eventbrite, you'll find, I'm sure that's the only one that's there. And so it is open to the public. It does require a registration. It's free, but we have a limited number of tickets, and so we do require pre-registration.
Wow, free?
It is free.
That'd be worth driving down from the Logan area, and if you're in Davis or Weber County or close enough to drive, that sounds like a great class.
Yeah, so we've had a number of projects here at Utah State University that have been funded by USDA and other agencies to learn more about how we can grow fruits and vegetables with organic methods here in the Intermountain West. And so that's what's going to be kind of a result. This workshop is sharing some of the things that we've learned. We also have a guest speaker coming from Washington State University, who's going to cover orchard ground cover management and mulches. He's been working with that for quite a few years.
Well, we have our first question. It comes from a listener in the Uinta Basin. She says, what do you do to get rid of borers in a globe willow tree?
Okay, so
cut down the globe willow tree.
Yeah, you know, hear on Brian's answer, but I know that's not what you want to hear. Globe willow or any of the willow poplar types of trees, they're popular. Haha, poplars are popular because they grow quickly, and we have a challenge with growing, very dense wooded trees here in the Intermountain West because we're such a dry climate, a lot of long cold winters. We had a really long cold winter this year. Uinta Basin, you know that best. And so it's hard, you know, you can plant a maple or an oak, and, you know, maybe by the time you're, if you did that when you're a teenager, by the time you're a late adult, you might have a really nice, beautiful tree. And so that's why these poplars, willows are popular to plant. So I understand that. But then the real downside to them, well, there's a number of them, but one of the biggies is that they're, because of that soft wood, they're very attractive to boring insects. And so we've had a real problem with carpenter worms in particular getting into globe willow trees. They make a really big hole and can kill the tree in a couple years
How big are these worms?
The caterpillars themselves are probably 2 inches long.
That's not a small caterpillar.
It's not a small caterpillar, and they're about, maybe... Not quite a half inch wide, but between a quarter and a half inch. So they're a good sized caterpillar, and they make big holes.
Do they just feed on the willows, or do they get into other soft wooded trees?
A number of the soft wooded trees, but willow, the globe willow is one of their favorites. And so the problem is, once you have an infestation like that, what can you do? If it's early on where you've just had the very first hole noticed and, you know, the tree isn't already riddled with holes, you could use, some protective insecticides. We have a fact sheet on the carpenter worm on our website that will tell you about the timing. It's going to be summer when the moths are active and laying eggs. I don't have the exact time in my head, but we can look it up. And you can use a protective insecticide spray on the trunk to help prevent further infestation. But if you've already got a lot of holes in the tree, a lot of tunnels, it's probably not worth doing anything other than just taking out the tree when it starts to decline.
Because it's already weak wood anyway. And if you've got holes all throughout it, then that's going to make it just that much more weak.
You're going to get a lot of limb breakage and limb drop. I know it's not a very, you'd like to hear something more positive that you could cure this problem, but unfortunately it's a tree that's attractive to these carpenter worms, and there's just not a lot you can do except put on a preventive insecticide spray, and a lot of people don't want to do that. I'm a person who doesn't want to go out and spray all my shade trees every year, so just tend to pick trees that don't tend to get that problem. I noticed when you were announcing the different activities that are going on, Wasatch Gardens especially, they mentioned that they're selling native and well-adapted plant materials to this area. And that's really the very first step to an integrated pest management program, that is trying to manage pests without having to use pesticides, is selecting plant materials that are well-adapted here and that don't tend to have pest problems. And aspen in the landscape is another chronic problem. A lot of people go up to the mountains, they see aspen looking beautiful there, and they want to, you know, emulate that in their home lawn. The problem is that down the valley, aspen doesn't grow very well. It tends to get iron chlorosis. It tends to get scale insects. It gets the aspen borer. And all those different kind of stresses combined tend to make aspen a pretty tough tree to grow in the landscape.
It's out of its native element.
It's out
so
of
all
its
of these other
element.
Insects that they don't have to compete with
exactly.
Up in the mountains or down here.
And so I know, again, people don't like to hear that when they have a specimen aspen tree in their landscape, and then you're telling them that, well, the best thing is just to probably not have that tree there. It's hard, but it's just something you have to kind of be willing to accept, that I need to grow the plant materials here that are well adapted to our environment. Many of them are native, or at least ones that are like the similar kinds of environment we have here.
Now, could this listener in the Uinta Basin put a systemic down? Would that work?
Probably not. And the reason for that is that these carpenter worms are, they're a large caterpillar, and they chew through the soft wood of the glow willow quite quickly, and they move throughout that inner wood area. So it's only when you use a systemic, it's going to be primarily in that phloem tissue area. And so as the insect chews through that as a young caterpillar, they might get some effect, some benefit of the insecticide. But once that caterpillar is larger and into interior wood on the tree, it's escaped being affected by the insect. Insecticide, excuse me. So not really that effective.
So is this a native caterpillar?
I believe it is native to this area. I'm not certain about that. I'd have
probably
to look
other
up.
Willows before yep. globe willows
yep.
came in.
Yep.
And found globe willows to be dessert.
Yep.
But or main course or whatever.
All kinds of willows are tough, tend to have pest problems. Probably weeping willow, one of the least problematic of the willow group, but pussy willows get borers. Many kinds of willows get borers and poplars.
But I don't even see that many weeping willows anymore because of the, is it?
Now you're talking about the birch.
Oh, birch borer.
The weeping
That's right.
birch.
You're
yeah,
right.
we don't
you're
see
right.
too many weeping birch anymore because the bronze birch borer is pretty much taking care of them all.
So where are these insects going once the trees are all gone?
Well, some of them probably, they might die out in an area if there's no local hosts available for it. Yeah.
Well, we have Diane Alston. She is our expert on all things insects. If you would like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. Go to zestygarden@gmail.com. Checking that one quite often. And then you can tweet us your question at #zestygarden. All right. So going back again to this borer, short of not planting the tree, if you have a tree then it's not infested, what really can you do to help prevent them from getting in?
There are some people who put on preventive sprays every year, whether they need it or not. I'm not an advocate for that because it means applying a lot of insecticide that is not necessary. But the problem is, if you wait until you have a borer in the tree, then you're
it's too late.
And it's too late. So it's really tricky.
Could you just spray the trunk?
Well, you do. That's what you spray, especially for the carpenter worm up around where the scaffold limbs attach. That's the primary. The lower part of the scaffold limbs and the upper part of the trunk is the primary area that the carpenter worm tends to attack. So you can do that, but again, I would look around. Do you see other willow trees in the area that have borers? If you do, then you do need to protect your trees. But if you are in an area that's fairly isolated and don't see that problem, well, then I wouldn't be putting on regular sprays.
Our next question comes from Kathy in Hyde Park. Hi, Kathy. How can we help?
Hello. I while I was pruning my apple tree, discovered that I've got a major scale infestation. So when is the best time to spray that?
Okay, so on your apple tree, the name of the scale is called San Jose scale, so named for San Jose, California, but it is native here in the West United States and into the Rocky Mountain region. And there's a couple of options. The first option is that dormant oil spray that we've just been talking about. So if you look at the buds on your apple tree, mm-hmm. you don't yet see anything poking out, do you? Any
no,
tissue?
No.
Yeah, so you're still have time. So right when those buds swell and open and you see just a little bit of green leaf tissue showing, I recommend putting on a dormant oil spray. And so it's a product you can buy at a local garden store called a dormant oil.
Okay.
And you put it on at 2% concentration. And you want to coat the limbs of the tree up down to where the limbs attach to the trunk. You don't want to spray the lower part of the trunk because we have beneficial predatory mites that overwinter there.
Okay.
So that's the first step. And that will help. It won't completely kill all the scale because they do have a little armor or protection over their body mm-hmm. that protects them, but you'll kill some of them that way. The next time of opportunity is when the little crawler stage that hatches out of the eggs hatch. And that tends to be late May, early June in northern Utah. And at that time, you can use a horticultural oil. So this would be a summer weight oil. You can also use an insecticide. And pretty much any of the fruit tree insecticides that are registered will provide you some control.
Will the oil work as well as the insecticide?
Yes, the oil will also help suffocate, and you could combine them together to give kind of a double whammy. I would really recommend you sign up for the free tree fruit pest advisory, because this will tell you when San Jose scale crawlers are active in different parts of the state. And you can sign up for this by either going, there's a couple different options. You can go straight to utahpests.usu.edu and then select the integrated pest management portal. And right there is a place that you can click on and sign up for a free subscription to, there's four different kinds of advisories. There's one for tree fruits, one for landscape ornamentals, and one for small fruits and veggies, and one for turf.
And they'll send one out and say, okay, they're active here in these parts of the state. And you can also go to upr.org and click on programs and then the Zesty Garden. And I have a direct link on our Zesty Garden webpage to sign up for those.
Okay, thank you.
You're sure welcome, Kathy. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I cannot say enough good about these advisories. It tells you exactly what's going on, where insects are erupting, certain types of insects, and what you need to do. And I it's invaluable to me for coddling moth control, because I don't use chemicals. I spray with spinosad, which lasts a little bit longer than the BT, but if it affects only the insects with chewing mouth parts, as I've learned on this program.
Right.
So the caterpillars, it doesn't hurt the other insects. And I don't spray more than twice a year, because I'm able to look with this particular advisory. It'll say this is when you should start spraying in Cache County to get this much control.
Right.
And even it'll have Smithfield, Providence, and one other town usually that I can look at.
Right. River Heights, I believe.
Yeah, River Heights is the one.
I think there's a monitoring station at Zollinger Orchards in River Heights is where some of that data comes from. And we have weather station data for those areas too.
And these are all free. You just sign up for them.
Right. So I really need to acknowledge my colleague, Marion Murray. She's the one who does these advisories. She works with me in the Integrated Pest Management Program, where we get some funding from USDA. We also get funding here from the state of Utah to help run this program. And so she herself, as well as she has some volunteer, and then she has some hired students that help her in scouting. So they go out on a regular basis throughout the later spring and summer to different parts of northern Utah. And we have scouts, volunteer scouts, and other places down in the southern part of the state. And they send her the information that what they're seeing at different times. And we have pheromone traps and sticky traps and different ways that the insects and pests are monitored. And that's what helps her then be able to build or develop those IPM advisories that go out. We now, over all of our advisories and our newsletter combined, we have over 20,000 subscribers. So we're really proud of that. We've really grown that program from just a few hundred when it started to over 20,000 people that receive those free advisories.
20,000?
Over 20,000 people.
Wow. Is that, where are the counties? Where are they?
All throughout the state. You know, I mean, we have people from all over. I'd say it's, you know, more heavily in the north, because we tend to have more information here in the north where Utah State University is located. But we have county agents in every county, and a lot of them participate in this program, and they help us with getting master gardener volunteers that are willing to put up a coddling moth trap, willing to go out and look for aphids, that kind of thing, and share that information with Marion, and then she can feed that into the IPM advisory. So it's a really great system, and it is money from our federal government that helps support this, as well as from our state and from USU Extension. But what a value you get for your dollar spent to be able to get much better management of the pests in your landscape and garden. without having to use as many pesticides.
Well, we have just a few minutes left in the program. If you want to get in a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or go to Gmail. This is our Gmail address. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or tweet us your question. I'm still waiting for a first gardening question through our website at #zestygarden. And so my last question to you, Diane, is going to be kind of going back to borers again. The longer, colder winters sure seem to suppress the populations in the mountains, hopefully. But how's the battle going with spruce tips and pine bark beetles?
Well, we are very concerned about some of the bark beetles in the urban areas because we're moving into a drought period, which the Ips bark beetle tends to, that's when it erupts, is when we get into drought conditions, because that's when the trees become stressed. And in our last kind of drought cycle, 7-10 years ago, we really learned that a Colorado blue spruce, which is native here and well adapted to our environment. But we learned that where it's planted on dry locations, south-facing slopes, planted with too much crowding, oftentimes we see that in parks and around cemetery borders, things like that, even people's lawns, that any kind of stress really made them more susceptible to being attacked by this Ips bark beetle. And so we're seeing an uptick in numbers of Ips samples and emails about that turned out when we diagnosed the problem, it turns out to be Ips in the last couple of years, especially this last year. So we're anticipating with the predictions for a hot, dry summer that we're going to see more Ips bark beetle problems here in Utah, unfortunately.
So basically, don't assume that if you have a pine, some kind of a conifer within your lawn, for instance, mm-hmm. that your watering of the grass is going to be enough to keep the Ips out of your tree.
The large conifers, 20, 30 foot tall trees, they need occasional deep watering to really get the moisture down into the depth of the root zone for these larger trees. And so just putting on your sprinklers for 30 minute sets or 45 minute sets, 2-3 times a week, even where you're keeping your lawn very lush and green, doesn't necessarily mean, as you said, that you're getting enough water to that the root zone of that large tree. So you do need to do at least once a month deeper watering, where you just take a hose, for example, and run a trickle for a longer period of time, a 24-hour period or something.
And we've talked about this in the past, but I still find it fascinating how evolution has made it so that the beetles know when to go after the trees, because the trees put off
stress chemicals
that
the beetles pick up on.
Which is, you'd think the tree would eventually overcome that by not putting that out.
I think they would have learned by now. But no, it's true. There is this, it is a real interesting chemical ecology going on where stressed trees do put out higher levels of pinenes and other kinds of chemicals that the bark beetles pick up on. But the other big thing about bark beetles is they are very tiny. They are like an eighth of an inch long, really tiny little beetles. So one bark beetle attacking a tree is nothing. The tree may not respond at all, or it may push a little sap out through that hole, and the bark beetle is thwarted. But what happens is the bark beetles then put out another, they take the chemicals from the tree that they just fed on, produce pheromones that they use to call or aggregate other beetles to come and join them. And so then they come with many beetles coming to attack the tree in mass. That's when the defenses of the tree cannot stand up to that. And a stressed tree is going to be more susceptible to succumbing than a very healthy tree. And that's when the bark beetle infestation really happens.
Is it a matter with the tree of having enough moisture in it to be able to do and put the sap into those holes?
Exactly. All of that is related. So being able to, just like the human body, if we get dehydrated, our body chemistry isn't working as well as it is, as well as we don't have enough water in our tissues to do the functions. It's the same thing in the tree. The same thing happens.
You mean I can get a bore in my leg?
Well, no. We don't. Well, there are some insects that bore into humans. We don't want to go there.
Yeah. But, you know, if we don't drink enough water, we can get cramps.
Right.
So I guess this is the tree is cramping. It's just doing it with some help.
But you're right. It cannot produce the volumes of sap it needs to push those beetles out there, or any invading pests that are trying to attack. And also it makes it's more concentrated. The chemicals in its sap are more concentrated, and that's what the beetles are picking up on. So it makes them more susceptible that way as well.
Now, something else that's coming to mind, and I think it's still like a month away or so, but I need to double check with you. Controlling the various insects on raspberries. I know there's a control that's coming up. I just don't remember what it is. And that's what the plant pest advisory is really helpful
right.
for. It'll say when to spray for it. But
so we have three different kinds of insects that bore in the canes of raspberries and related brambles here in Utah. Unfortunately, there's that many. And so the raspberry horntail we've talked a lot about on the show is the most common one in northern part of the state. So let's plan to talk about that a month from now. That will be getting to the timing late May, early June, when those are attacking the canes, and we can give some more specific information there.
And now there's a fourth pest, the spotted wing Drosophila, which
another invasive.
We'll find out this year to see if its populations have spread or not.
So far, it's only been found in Davis County. Kaysville, Layton, Fruit Heights areas have had it. It hasn't spread beyond that, so we're hoping that our environment is not conducive for it, so to help it spread. But it's been here 3 years now, so we're continuing to monitor and see.
Anything else that's coming to mind about this time of year?
Well, I would just say we've had a cool start to our year, at least up here in the north, I guess.
I mean, it was pretty dry in March,
only
like about 25% of normal precipitation. It was starting to warm up. I thought, oh, no, we're going to have a really hot, warm summer or spring. Then April hit, and it's not been especially wet. It's just been cold.
Been cold. But that's been hard on even some of our coal crops and things that normally can do very well this time of year. It's just been tough with that dry conditions and cool weather. But I would say as a gardener, make sure that you have enough water in your soil profile because we did not get the moisture buildup that we typically get in the spring. I know I have a dirt driveway, and my dirt driveway is already very dusty.
Dusty.
In April. Sad.
Yikes. And I was looking at my rain gauge, and I think April, it's usually supposed to be just over 2 inches, and I know we've still got a few days left, but
we're way below that.
And I'm only at about 1.7, I think.
Well, and you're higher than some people, too. I think some people are less than that, so...
Well, thank you for being on the program this week.
That's my pleasure. Good luck with the fun drive, and remember Zesty Garden, and if you appreciate that show, that you should call in and show your support.
And do you want to give the phone number?
Oh, there
it
is.
On the window.
On the window. 1-800, I can't see
all the way over. Try the other window. Oh, there you go. Thanks, April.
1-800-826-1495. Call in and show your support for the local UPR shows such as Zesty Garden.